Let me turn things over to Paul.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our free call. Today, the topic, as James said, is setting and achieving goals. It's pretty interesting. If you look at the statistics on goal setting, the research shows that only about 3% of the world population has any sort of written or structured goals whatsoever. And of the 3% of the population that has goals, the world's wealth is owned by 2% of the 3%. So 98% of the money in the world can be tracked back to 2 of the 3% of the people that have goals. The rest of the world population, only 2 to 3% of the world population makes more than $100,000 a year, and almost 100%, about 99% of those people making less than $100,000 a year do not have any written goals whatsoever. It's a pretty shocking set of statistics, and there's all sorts of variations on the theme out there, but they all point in the same direction. An interesting correlation to that is that research shows that 98% of all the people in the world that have won the lotto or lotteries are broke within 1 year of winning the lottery. Now, why is this important to goal setting? Because it shows you that even if you take somebody that doesn't have any money and you give them $1 million, the same person that does not know how to manage themselves and create a matrix or a structure for channeling energy doesn't generally have a matrix or a structure for handling energy of any type. So the same person that has a hard time managing money, has a hard time managing diet, has a hard time managing an exercise program, has a hard time managing their emotions, etc. This is where the saying, the way you do anything is the way you do everything, comes from. And after 24 years of therapy and coaching and teaching, I can pretty much assure you that it's a generalization that's pretty much a realization. Now, when it comes to goal setting, it's important to realize that all ideas exist in the mind of the universe. So this is where the saying, there's nothing new under the sun, comes from. Now, the reality of it is that even if you were to think of something brand new, that is completely novel, that has never been done anywhere in the history of life, you wouldn't know you'd done it, because as a conscious being in the universe, your brain taps into the mind of the universe, and each one of us creates constantly using the mind of the universe. So you wouldn't even know if you had created a new idea or not. The good news is that you are conscious, therefore aware of your idea. Even if it's an old idea that exists, for example, Hippocrates used to use medicine balls to train his patients, to exercise them. So today, anybody that picks up a medicine ball and starts thinking of ideas could very well be picking up on ideas that Hippocrates came up with thousands of, or hundreds of, at least, you know, several hundred, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. I believe he lived 400 BC, if I remember right. So you could be tapping into ideas on how to use a medicine ball that were actually ideas created by Hippocrates, and you would think that they were your own. The key thing is it doesn't really matter, because you might sit at your desk and think of 20 new ways to use a medicine ball, but if you don't do something about it, one, if you don't write them down, an hour later you might only remember 10 of the 20 ideas you came up with. So the first phase of goal setting is to think about what you want to accomplish. The second phase is to take it from the thought phase of creation into the word, which means writing it down or putting a more dense vibration on it. So if you think of something, that's a high vibration. If you write it down, that's a slower, more materialistic experience or expression. So you have the idea to build a house, and then you begin setting goals by having a set of blueprints drawn up by an architect, and that brings it closer to realization. Hey, how do you tell them how to mute the phones, James? Whoever that is that's got a siren near them, I need you to mute your phone, please.
Right. You can mute your phone by pressing star 6.
You'll still be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Okay, so what you do then is you are bringing the idea into gestation. Once you write it down, then you must take action. Okay, so you're essentially giving birth to an idea, and I'll give you an analogy. A chicken gives birth to an egg. So an egg is an idea. It's the idea for a chicken. Yet just because the chicken lays the egg, it can't just walk away from it and expect chicks to jump out of the eggs in a few weeks or whatever. It has to sit there and keep the eggs warm and energized and love the idea. Love is the most powerful creative force in the universe. So whenever you're in love with an idea, you channel your own life force and your own energy into the idea. So the chicken sits on the eggs, warms them and loves them, and that energizes the idea. And then when the idea comes to life, the chick hatches out of the egg, and that is the equivalent of the house finishing being built, that equivalent of the race car builder finishing the race car, or the architect, you know, finishing the high-rise building. So I want to just take you quickly through the process of how an idea comes to life. First, you have to have a dream. We always ideally set goals to achieve a dream. If it's your dream to go on vacation and your goal is to save $10,000 in 6 months, then that's the dream. That is the positive pole, the positive experience. A negative experience would be that you didn't achieve the goal, but right now we're going to popularize this. So the first thing you have to do, any dream that's in the idea stage is positively charged. We are here on Earth, which is the negative pole. So the mind of the universe is the positive pole, the Earth plane is the negative pole, and love brings the two together. So you energize the idea, and by putting your love and your attention on it, you create an attractive force. Whenever you put attention into an idea on the Earth plane, you begin to create a polarity circuit, and it's your consciousness that is creating the polarity that's bringing the idea into fruition. So think of an electromagnet. The more energy you put into the electromagnet, the more of an attract force it becomes, and it begins to pull all magnetic things towards it in relationship to how energized it becomes. And if you get a big enough electromagnet, you can pick up a car with it. They use them in junkyards. So it's important to realize that any idea exists in a very, very subtle, almost invisible form called a thought form. And, for example, when you close your eyes and envision your favorite car or envision your new house, as you energize this idea with love and emotion, it starts to magnetize itself. And to the degree that you magnetize it with your love and your attention, it causes a materialization. The idea starts drawing energy to itself. The same way when a mother hen sits on an egg, her energy and her love and her warmth energizes the chick idea, and as the chick idea is energized, it uses the yolk and the nutrition of the egg to grow itself. It's actually using its mother's energy and its mother's love to power it. Otherwise, the mother wouldn't have to sit on the eggs. So the idea is there. but the environment has to be right, and it is the mother's love and energy that creates the environment that opens the gateway for the idea of the chicken to enter into the through the egg. So the process of goal setting is one that requires first intention. So if you have the idea for a house, you must have some intention. You want to build a house to use it as a commercial real estate property, or you want to live in the house, or you want to build a house with a spare room to rent out. The point is, though, that the reason you wanted to build the house is because you have a specific intention. The idea exists in the spiritual realm or the mind of the universe as a thought form, and when you put your intention in it, it brings spirit, the energy of the universe or the divine, into tension. The word intention means in tension. So you put spirit or space, or what's called in quantum physics the zero point field, which is just space, you bring space into tension, and your use of your attention puts the energy of the idea, it creates a polarity between you and the idea, which brings it to your attention. So your intention is to make it live, and your attention, the mother pays attention to the eggs. That puts spirit at tension. So first you put it in tension, and you hold it at tension. So the same way you use a rope to tow a car. Your intention is to tow the car, but you can't just jerk on the rope or it'll tear the bumper off the car. You got to gently bring it to attention or at tension, and then the car begins to move. But the only way you can take an intention and put it at tension is through your awareness. So you use your awareness to channel your life force and your love into the idea. Because life force or spirit exists everywhere in the universe at the same time, by using your awareness, you bring an awareness, a location to the non-local. In other words, you use thought to stimulate the quantum field to bring energy through intention to tension, which then attracts life to the idea. Now, to conclude, I want to make a couple of comments on why a lot of people don't set goals. One is many people that I've counseled over the years said, well, I set goals, but I don't achieve them, so it just upsets me, so I said, screw it, and stop setting goals. But one of the things that people do is they put down too many goals, so they have more eggs than one hen can keep warm and love. So rule number one is what I say to my students, how many turkeys have you got in the oven? You can only put so many turkeys in the oven before you don't have enough energy to cook them, and the more turkeys you have in the oven, the longer it takes to cook any one turkey. So always get clear on goal setting as to which is the most important turkey to put your love and your energy into, or you can suffer and be like a jack of all trades, master of none. You can divide your energy too much. Number two, most people are unrealistic in the gestational period. On average, it takes 9 months for a mother to bring a human fetus into the world as an infant. Now, it doesn't matter how much the father or the grandparents stand around whining and complaining and rushing the mother or knocking on the mother's stomach, encouraging the child to come out. If the child comes out before 9 months, it's not fully developed and it reduces its chance of survival. And if the child stays in there too much longer than 9 months, it suffocates the idea, again reducing its chances of survival. So it's always important to be very conscious of the natural gestation period for any idea. It typically would take you about a year to build a house if you did it on your own and maybe hired a few subcontractors that did most of the work on your own. If you hire a professional, they can build you a house in you know, 1 to 3 months if you want to spend the money to have it done that fast. But if you went to a contractor and said, listen, I need a 5-bedroom, 2,500-square-foot house with a 2-car garage built, and I need it done in a week, they would look at you and say, listen, that's not possible unless you want to spend $1 million and have 15 crews going at once, because that's too short of a gestation period for a house. So always get clear on a realistic gestation period for your goals, or you will become disappointed, because you can either expect something too soon or go too slow and the idea gets stale. How do you do this? You use what I call reverse engineering. If you've never built a house before, phone up a couple of contractors and say, listen, I'm going to build a house. This is my budget. I can hire people to do the roofing, the cement work. I want to do the finish work myself. I'll put the cabinets. I'll put the stove in. But what would be a normal amount of money and a normal amount of time based on these criteria to build a house? Now, they're going to tell you probably a year. So what you do is you reverse engineer. Then you talk to a general contractor, and he says, now the first thing you got to do is clear the land. Next, you got to dig the foundation. Next, you got to lay the floor. Next, you got to put the walls and the ceiling up. And then before you go any further, you got to bring in the electrician and the plumber, because they can't work when the gyprock is up. So you reverse engineer this process, and you basically go backwards, and by going from the completed house and working backwards, you can lay it out in stepwise fashion, and then you have your general goals, and then underneath the general goals, you might say, okay, the first thing I got to do is clear the land, so my goal is to clear the land within a month, and in order to clear the land, I'm going to have to rent a chainsaw, and if you don't know how to use a chainsaw, you're going to have to learn how to use a chainsaw. So you reverse engineer backward to the point that you're at. And since each of us has different skills, different abilities, and different financial capacities, how we reverse engineer the goal always depends on our abilities, our skills, and our available energy, which could be finances, which could be your personal energy, etc. Those are some key points on the importance of goal setting. In the program, in the Mastery Program Lesson 3, I take you through goal setting. I talk to you about the current science of goal setting, and I share techniques that I've learned and developed from my own goal setting. And it's very, very important to learn to set goals, because they channel your energy. Whenever you set goals, you create an energetic structure through which energy flows. So think of it like the fuel injection system or the carburetor on a car. If the mouth of the carburetor is too big, then you get too much oxygen into the car and it doesn't run right. If you strangle the carburetor, it starves to death. So we're trying to create, through goal setting, an optimal flow for energy. The carburetor is just, or the fuel injection system on a car is just a matrix through which air flows, meets fuel, they fall in love with each other, and their marriage in the engine creates ignition. That ignition produces energy. Energy produces movement. And the car allows you to get from one place to the next to achieve your goal. The beautiful thing about all goal setting is anytime we achieve any goal, we automatically help other people achieve their goals, because anytime we energize and bring any goal into life, we teach the universe how to do it. So each time any one of us is a successful goal setter and goal achiever, we make it easier for all other sentient beings to achieve goals, and therefore we produce evolution. The word evolution means little to big. The more competent and the more capable we all are, the more we teach the less competent and the less capable to be competent. And that is a good reason to set goals by itself. Does anyone have any questions?
Hi, Paul. This is Jules here.
How do you say your name?
Jules.
Oh, Jules. Hello.
Mine's more of an emotional and spiritual question.
Okay.
So frequently during my spiritual practices, I'm experiencing a lot of physical pain, and it's pain that I haven't really felt before. It's more almost like a surgical, and it feels very precise in nature, and it moves through me. And there's two types of pain. One is one that's my own that I know I hold energetically, and the other is almost like it's being done to me at the time. I don't have any emotional connection during my meditation or whatever I'm doing, but afterwards I feel I cry and I feel really hurt and a deep sense of loss. And on one hand I'm very unsettled, but another I'm also very calm.
Yep.
And I've been sitting with this and trying to work out the lesson that I'm meant to move towards or what I'm meant to learn. And I'm getting guided back to, the first 16, 17, 18 years of my life, and my survival mode was to just shut down physically, mentally, and emotionally.
Right.
As escapism.
Okay. And how can I help you?
Well, I guess I'm asking you for clarity. And
I'll give it to you. You ready?
Yep.
First of all, I would recommend you get the book Vibrational Medicine by Richard Gerber. Have you ever heard of it?
Yep.
Okay.
I have it, actually. I just haven't picked it up and read it.
Okay. In the book Vibrational Medicine, he gives a very comprehensive explanation as to why what you're describing happens to people. It has to do with the way chi flow moves through the four ventricles of the human brain. Typically, these problems begin on the left side of the body, and they work their way through to the right side of the body, and then they complete themselves. What you're describing is a process, by the way, that stops most people from meditating. Because as people start to meditate, or do any kind of Tai Chi or Qigong, they bring more life force into their body, and because life force or Chi or Prana is actually love, love always does the best thing to help you become whole and healthy again, which means to go through your body and identify any part of you that is currently not healed. So any of the physical, emotional, mental, or spiritual wounds, not only from this lifetime, but any past lifetime that you've not fully resolved, begin to heal. And so many people get scared and think something's wrong or shy away from their chi or meditative practice because they actually think that it hurts and they give up on it. But the reality of it is the more it hurts, the more you need it. So just regulate the amount of it by your tolerance, but know that what you're having is actually the same as what's called a Herxheimer reaction in medicine, and that's called the healing reaction or the healing response. So, for example, if someone gets in a whiplash injury and knocks their neck out of place and they don't know it's out of place, and then 3 months later they come to me and I mobilize their neck, even though I've put their neck back in place, it can be extremely painful going through the process of taking a vertebra that's subluxed and putting it back into position, and then when it's in position, their muscles start to ache like crazy, they might get headaches, they might get spasms throughout their body, and they call me on the phone and they go, "My God, what did you do to me? It feels like I've just had another whiplash." And I explain, yes, this is happening because your body's actually going through a process now of unwinding. It's adapted to the injury. And now I had to move, and I had to stretch all the tissues that were too short to put the bone back in place, and all the tissues that were too long now have to shorten, which means I have to excite those muscles, and that process can literally hurt almost as bad as the original injury because the body itself can't tell the difference. It just knows that it's being stretched into a new position and that the change is uncomfortable. So when you're doing your practice, there's a very distinct, well-mapped-out pathway that the chi flows through the body, and Richard Gerber describes it in detail because it's been researched scientifically, and he shows you the process, and many people that go through this process and get what's called Kundalini rising, which usually takes a yogi about 7 years to achieve, oftentimes people have these things happen spontaneously, and they end up in psychiatric wards because they don't know how to manage the energy when it rises up through the spine, and they have not been in a spiritual practice, because things like flashing lights and vibration can trigger a Kundalini rising. You're describing exactly that process. It's normal. It's healthy. And my suggestion to you would be, when these emotions rise up, do what I teach in the Mastery Program called Management by Detachment. Lesson 1 and Lesson 2 in the Mastery Program are absolutely critical for you to clear this, because a lot of your pain is going to be attached to ideas that were programmed into you by your parents and by society in the first 14 years of your life. So what can happen is you can actually go through the healing process, and let's say that you're healing from a fear of a loss of security that rose out of your childhood because your parents fought about money, and money was always an issue. And so now, as you're doing your meditative practice and you start healing this fear about money, if it rises up in you, yet you keep repeating the same behavior, the question is, can you heal when you're recreating the wound as fast as you're healing it? So in lesson 1, I teach you how to get core values and a legacy developed, and then in lesson 2, I teach you how the nervous system and the brain are actually programmed, and I show you how to identify the parts of your childhood and your life all the way up till now, where the programming came from, so that when it comes up, you can identify the program and rewrite the software and use your meditative or your Tai Chi, Qigong exercise practice as a tool to both reprogram and reinforce. That's exactly what's happening. Does that help?
It helps. Thank you, Paul.
That's exactly what you got going on, and don't give up, but just make sure you do the kind of work I'm telling you about, or you're likely to continue to be like a ball just bouncing repeatedly against a wall.
A lot of what you said has helped me a great deal, because I did feel like I was heading for a psychiatric institute shortly.
Yeah, well, don't do that, because all they'll do is give you drugs and tell you there's something wrong with you. And Richard Gerber is writing his book, and I've got several, there's entire books on how people that have these spiritual practices end up in psych wards, because nobody really understands what's happening. A lot of yoga teachers don't even understand it, because in this country, we are surrounded by so-called self-made experts that don't even understand what they're teaching. They're not real teachers. In India, if you went to a real yoga teacher, they would recognize the symptoms immediately and know how to manage you. But in this country, we fake it, hoping to make it, and I don't want you to do that.
I won't do that either. So thank you for your advice.
You're welcome.
Paul, I have a question for you.
Hit me.
My name is Nancy. I'm actually a practitioner of yours, and I've been practicing some Qigong lately and working on some of my own issues, got my organic food going in me and eating for my metabolic type, but I've noticed that I've got some tachycardia going on in my heart.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with me physically, and some of the stuff that you just said kind of struck a nerve with me, and I'm wondering if that might be what's going on with me too.
Yeah, that can be. Anytime you're having a spiritual awakening, you're becoming something new, and there's what's called a shadow self. The shadow self is made of two things, parts of your personality that you don't see and don't commonly express.
Uh-huh.
So an extrovert has an introverted shadow. An introvert has an extroverted shadow. So if an extrovert comes to a party, they always want to be the life of the party, don't they? Okay, so if you take an extrovert and bring them to a meditation class, what's likely to happen to them when everybody's silent and shutting their mind off?
Have trouble sitting still.
Right, because that now they have to look right at their shadow. But the introverts love to meditate, right, because that's their mode of behavior. So the reality of it is that the introverts that like hanging out in meditation classes because it's easy for them would be far better off to go to a Toastmasters meeting and learn how to speak publicly, because that takes them into their shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you take an introvert and say, okay, today you're going to practice public speaking, go ahead and stand up in front of the room and tell us for 5 minutes all about yourself, how many of them do you think are going to get tachycardia right then and there?
A lot of them.
There you go, my dear. You just figured out what's going on.
Okay, that makes sense.
Your practice is taking you into the shadow, but you've heard the term to be illuminated, right?
Yes.
So a sage or a wise man is illuminated. Buddha, it was fully illuminated. Osho was a highly illuminated being. When somebody's illuminated, it means that they have actually shined light on the part of themselves that is hiding and normally holds them back. An illuminated person has a healthy, fulfilled ego. Many people don't realize that someone like Jesus Christ or Buddha had a very, very healthy ego.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot get rid of your ego, because if you get rid of your ego, you'll cease to exist. Okay? So the process of enlightenment, which is what all these chi practices are for, which just means to become a free thinker and to manage your mind, which only 1% of humanity can do, by the way, the process is one in which you have to heal the ego. And every time you do anything that makes you more whole, you illuminate the shadow, but the shadow is alive.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, for example, when you shine, when you put a movie projector on, it's the shadows that allow you to see the light. If there was no shadows, you wouldn't be able to see the light. So the shadow function serves. And then as one becomes more illuminated, they need less and less contrast. So, you know, there's four stages to learn how to love. The first stage is sex and violence. This is why you see so many wars and so many battles, because human beings are still only between the first and second chakra in their overall development. So we need a lot of sex and violence, because as sick as it sounds, we feel fulfilled by bumping into each other. So look at what are the most popular sports on television? Football,
yeah.
Boxing, hockey, because everybody loves to see people bump into each other, and then the sex is very popular. Anything that improves your sexuality sells. So we sell sex and violence because it's the first phase of learning how to love. But when you become more mature, you're interested in less violent forms of love. So the second phase of loving is just to learn what basic love is without sex and violence. The third phase of love is to learn to be empathetic and compassionate to people, which doesn't require that you even be present with them in the physical. In other words, you don't have to touch, you don't have to kiss, you don't have to stroke. You are just present with them, and you care for them. And the final phase is unconditional love, which only happens at the highest level. So Jesus getting crucified and Buddha spending 42 years of his life answering questions are examples of high, high levels of love approaching unconditional love. The process that you're going through and that the previous woman spoke of are tied into your very own process of moving through the stages of becoming an unconditional lover.
That makes perfect sense to me. I mean, because it only happens when I'm at rest. It doesn't happen when I'm training. It happens when I'm quiet. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah, that's what it is, and it's natural. Also, those are symptoms of detoxification.
That makes sense.
And now that you've switched over to an organic diet, you're feeding your liver the nutrition it needs to begin releasing toxic metabolites that are stored in the fat and so the body will start upregulating the metabolism as the nutrition is available, and then it will begin to process the toxins. And many of these toxins cause tachycardia. For example, if I go to a regular coffee shop and have a coffee or an espresso made from commercially grown coffee, it frequently gives me tachycardia because it's a common symptom from pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and rodenticides, and coffee is one of the most heavily sprayed crops in the world. And being that I pretty much 99% of the time eat an organic diet and only drink organic espresso, my body's very, very clean and sensitive. So most people go to Starbucks every day and don't feel a thing. That's because they're that dead.
Right. Okay.
But when you start healing, you become more and more alive, which makes you more and more sensitive to your internal and external environment. So you're probably actually working your way through all the toxins in your body as well as the spiritual stuff. And it's important to realize this because, once again, as I said to the previous lady, lots of people go, my God, this spiritual stuff, this healing's for the birds. I'll just go back to eating Oreo cookies, smoking cigarettes, and drinking beer. And there you have the U.S. population at large.
Thank you very much. That helped a lot.
You're welcome. All right, are there any last-minute questions before we close the call for the day?
Hey, Paul, how you doing? My name's Roman. I took a lifestyle certification back in 2001 where it kind of opened my mind and stuff to chakras.
Good.
And with this goal setting, you did mention the fact of legacy, and I've kind of struggled with that slightly, wondering things of such nature like... at first it made complete sense that if I have a goal and it really doesn't pertain to my legacy, it's kind of useless. But then I kind of searched and thought about my legacy more and then kind of thought about like what a short span of time in the general scheme of things that, you know, my existence would be here. Like say for instance, take someone like Mother Teresa or Gandhi.
Yeah.
You know, as we study these people in history and generational, you know, it kind of loses its zeal in a way. You know, how does someone like myself, you know, think about it in those terms as far as how important my legacy would be or how it would pertain to goal setting?
Okay, well, first of all, there's no difference between you and Mother Teresa or you and Gandhi except that they were fully self-realized and invested in their legacy.
Okay.
The reason Mother Teresa does what she does is because she knows who she is and she knows who you are. She's enlightened. So anybody that's enlightened knows who every human being is, knows who every living creature on the planet is, why they're here, and what the purpose of that is. You just happen to have mentioned the names of two enlightened beings, right? So Mother Teresa knows who she's helping. I'm trying to keep the religious words out of this, not to taint the conversation into a religious conversation. But Gandhi, let's just say Gandhi's legacy was to free the Indian people from British rule, and he wanted to teach the world how to achieve a goal nonviolently. That was his legacy, and his legacy was so big that he was willing to channel all of his love and all of his life force into the legacy. Now, so Gandhi showed the world how to do that. Mother Teresa shows the world how to do what she does. You are showing the world how to do what you do. And to the degree that you understand what your legacy is, it becomes easier for you to sacrifice the mundane. Okay, so what is the mundane? That means getting involved in relationships with people that don't work for you. It means going out and getting shit-faced drunk at night and hanging out with the guys instead of doing the necessary work or research to execute your legacy. Okay? So these are what I call legacy parasites.
Are you in the home?
This is the function of lesson one. Lesson one takes you through these steps, the first step program, takes you through these steps very carefully and puts you through specific drills to draw out the necessary information to create the structure so you know how to channel your life force. Now, the reality of it is very few people know their legacy, because what is your legacy? It's your overarching dream. It's what you came here to do as a human being, and you may not find that out. So what we do is we focus on what are called core values. By studying and investigating and getting clear on your core values then guide you toward the people that have similar core values, and when you're with those people, you begin to resonate with those people, and that guides you towards your legacy. And the reality of it is that your legacy may also be someone else's legacy.
Okay.
Right? So, for example, my legacy is to teach as many people in the world as possible how to have a healthy body, how to balance and manage their emotions and use their mind effectively so that they can fully experience and enjoy the knowledge and the wisdom and the zest of the soul. But you can never really fully connect with your soul if your body's not healthy, if your emotions are out of balance and you don't know how to use your mind, because the soul uses the mind and the emotions and the body as its tools of expression. So if I gave you a toolbox full of tools but didn't teach you how to use them as a mechanic, you could have the best toolbox in the world, and even though you wanted to be a mechanic, I couldn't really expect you to do it without using, without learning how to use the tools. So through the process of setting your core values and developing your legacy, you then synchronize the physical, the emotional, the mental, and the spiritual, because the process of setting core values and living them brings the energy centers into harmony so that the flow of energy moves out of the spiritual world into the physical world, which are really one world, but they're polarized. And then all of a sudden you wake up one morning and you go, my God, I've got the house of my dreams, I've got the car of my dreams, I've got the woman of my dreams, I've got the job of my dreams, whammo! And now you're in it, you're there, and so the soul is dancing. And what do most people do? They walk around wishing they had more money, wishing they could take a vacation, wishing they had better relationships, but if wishing is a goal, that's what you get, is wishing.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's two kinds of goals that I teach. There's what are called process goals and outcome goals. It's very important to clearly understand that, because a process goal would say, my goal is to enjoy the process of achieving my legacy. An outcome goal is, my goal is to enjoy my legacy. So my process is to enjoy teaching people how to be healthy and manage themselves, but my legacy is experienced every day when I give lectures all over the world and I have over 8,000 Czech practitioners. So I've already achieved the outcome that I wanted. I developed a system of health and well-being that is being utilized by thousands and thousands and thousands of people around the world. So now it's more about the process, which means enjoy each day. Take the challenges, know that's part of the process. Don't run, don't hide, don't whine. Be present and enjoy the process. So the reason I bring that up is because when someone does not have a legacy, it's easy to give up and say, well, geez, why should I even bother? You know, I don't know what I'm here to do.
Right.
So they give up. That's when I say, well, the goal is to enjoy the process. So how do you set your day up? How do you set your life up so that you say, wow, this process of finding my legacy is cool, man. I'm digging this stuff.
Right?
Right? Then life has meaning even without a legacy. Then what you do is you say, I really like the ideals of a Mahatma Gandhi. I really like the ideals of a Mother Teresa. And what you've essentially said is, my core values resonate with Gandhi. My core values resonate with Mother Teresa. And so what do? You find yourself at a workshop given by Mother Teresa on how to teach the poor people to be more financially self-supportive. And now, the next thing you know, you're building a shelter for the homeless to teach them how to take care of themselves, and boom, you wake up one morning and you go, wow, look at that, I found my legacy. So you harmonize yourself to your legacy first by getting clear on your core values, which creates an attractive force that moves the right people towards you and moves you toward the right people.
Yeah, you know, Paul, I guess the part that really kind of helped the most, where you said there was a legacy parasite, what can hurt, actually, is that some of these people are actually family members. You know,
well, that's beautiful. That's absolutely beautiful, because who better to practice self-management on than the people that are always around you?
Right.
And as I said in my mastery call with my students today, I quoted Zarathustra, and I teach this in Lesson 1 in the Master Program. The famous, well, most people don't know him, he was famous at one time, but the Persian prophet Zarathustra, who started a religion called Zoroastrianism, said, your yes has no value until you learn to say no. And the people to practice that on first are the ones that love you.
Right.
Because they're the ones that are the most likely to give you honest resistance to keep you honest. So your parents ask you to go to church with them, and say you just don't feel going to church is for you anymore. If you say yes when you really want to say no, then you go there and you resent it, and you become resentful every time you say yes, and so it creates a gap between you and your parents, and it makes it less and less fun to be around. And you externalize that, and you go, geez, I really don't like my parents. But the truth is, you don't like yourself, because you kept saying yes when you wanted to say no. So your family always comes forward, and you have a spiritual contract with everybody in your family. Mm-hmm. And we all attract people to us in our families. When we're in the pre-birth state, we harmonize with the people that are going to give us exactly the pressure we need to become who we are supposed to be in this lifetime. And to the degree that we resist and don't take the offering, then life just looks like a bag of shit everywhere we go. We just complain, and you think, God, how did this happen? Why am I here? But the reality of it is, you're always getting exactly what you ask for.
Right. That's well said, Paul. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I'm going to see you Sunday, I guess, August 12th in New York.
I'll be there. Get ready.
I'll be there, too. Thank you, Paul.
All right. You're welcome. Any last-minute questions before I close the call? All right, James. It looks like we've concluded.
Great. Well, let me remind everybody that we'll be posting the recording of this call in a day or two. So, like I said, if you want to revisit it, you can get it on our website. And if you have any questions, or you have a question for a future call but you can't participate, you can always email me, that's James, at Dean, D-E-A-N, at ppssuccess.com, and I'm happy to ask your question for you or answer any other question you might have.
And if you know other people that need to hear the answers to these questions, feel free to have them visit the website, and they can download the call from today and take advantage of it themselves.
That's right.
Have a great day, everyone.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.